Hello and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo, episode 331. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me as always are James Jones.
Yep.
And Guillaume Veillette.
I need a blood transfusion or something. Anything for energy.
I'm telling you, man. We are fresh, except not so fresh, back from PAX East. You can probably tell that John is not here, which really sucks. And we thought he was going to be right up until a few hours ago. It turns out John's movers are the worst movers possibly in the world and took more than 10 days to deliver his furniture and electronics and a lot of other things from Boston to Atlanta. Now, I've never driven that exact route from Boston
it's
to Atlanta.
Long. It's like...
But I've driven a similar route. I've driven from Vermont to Huntsville, Alabama, which is very similar and actually a little bit longer, I think. Let me tell you right now, it did not take me 12 days.
About 13.
So... I don't know what the hell they were doing, but anyway, John has not been able to play any console games, has not been able to play Ease, and is not able to record a podcast tonight because his shit just showed up, and he is upset about it, and we are too.
Yeah, but to be fair to the movers, they had to go extremely slow because John's furniture is made entirely of popsicle sticks.
Yeah, and he had four trucks full of unplayed video games.
Yeah.
So there was a lot to transport, and there's a lot to unload once they got there. So anyway, John will be back next week, as far as we know. He certainly intends to be. And we're going to power on as a power trio tonight. So we're probably going to be a little bit leaner and meaner, but we still have a ton of games to talk about and a lot of listener mail coming up later in the show. We have delayed Retroactive until next week because none of us have had enough time to play it with all the crazy stuff going on with PAX. I don't know, scheduling it before and after PAX seemed like a good idea at the time, but in retrospect,
I basically got home from PAX and said, there's no fucking way I'm playing another minute of this before we talk about it.
Yeah, no, I'm excited to jump back into Ease. I have not had time. PAX just absolutely destroyed us, and then I've been playing catch up ever since.
I'm a champion. I'm good to go. I can do another PAX. Oh, I can do another PAX right now.
Hey, you know, the panel audio's up. Hopefully everybody's heard it. If not, I hope you will check it out. It's only an hour long, but it is jammed with really good Nintendo discussion. And thanks again to our friends Nate and Jared and Chris Kohler for doing that with us. We had a blast and got to talk to a lot of people before and after the panel. Who got to come out and see us, and we got to sign something again from Razor Kid.
Just as fucking creepy as it was last time.
Does not cease to be really weird feeling to sign autographs, but was really fun. And then the Nintendo Air panel, the connectivity panel that was the next day, they had a massive crowd. Apparently, if you give things away, a lot of people show up. I don't know if that was it. I don't know if it's the day or the time or what, but damn, they had a ton of people. And I got to participate in that. I was the phone a friend or phone an expert, and I got to go up there on the stage. So the audio for that should be up probably by the time you hear this. And I would definitely recommend that you listen to that as well. It's really fun. You get to hear what they do, which is really different from our panel. And they had some great participation. And, you know, you can hear a little bit of me on there too, along with a lot of other great people. So I hope you'll check that out. Anyway, we're going to jump into new business. And this is a lot of handheld stuff or leftover stuff, I guess. I'm going to talk about some stuff that I played at PAX East that we haven't talked about yet. But James is going to go first with the new hotness.
So I procured a copy of Luigi's Mansion Dark Moon / 2, depending on where you live. I am roughly, I believe there's 5 mansions. I'm through 3.
That's what I've heard.
I'm through 3 of them. So I'm making decent progress. There's plenty written about the game by now, so I don't need to go into too much detail. And it's Luigi's Mansion, so that's, you know, it is what it is. You collect ghosts of the vacuum. What separates this game quite a bit from its predecessor is how the game is structured. So, A, it makes some adaptions for not having two control sticks, but really the primary difference the game makes is that as opposed to being an exploration game where you're in a one giant mansion, and slowly the world opens up to you as you explore it. You're put in a series of mansions, but you're really put in these compartmentalized subsections of it, and you're warped in and out with specific objectives to complete once you arrive there. It makes it much more of a mission-based structure than a traditional survival horror, which, for all the comedy and ridiculousness of Luigi's Mansion, it really is structured like a survival horror game. It's very built in the same way a lot of the games of that era were built. I mean, it's physically, there's a lot of similarities control scheme-wise to Resident Evil game, for God's sake, for the old ones, not RE4.
That's not true.
No, you're playing from a third person, and you're having to point your weapons at things from angles that don't necessarily make sense on your viewpoint.
Look, the old Resident Evil games had you turn like a tank, and then you pushed up to move forward through pre-rendered static camera angles. It's just not anything like Luigi's Mansion.
It is. I'm sorry. I just get the same...
It's not.
I get the same feeling when I play them.
Well, okay, so I will admit that the, you know, the whole diorama presentation of Luigi's Mansion is reminiscent of certain pieces of Resident Evil, because Resident Evil sometimes gave a similar view on the level. Sometimes they stuck the camera way up in the corner and looked down on things.
That's the best. I'm sorry. That was the best times.
No, that's the worst. But the way that the character actually controls is not similar at all.
Never mind. It's irrelevant.
You play the first Resident Evil with a D-pad.
Anyway, this game, I don't know, it also dumped I'm not sure what you'd call them, the specialty ghosts.
They were the portrait ghosts.
Yeah, they're out too, which is kind of a weird drop. What you end up with is you end up with a much more compartmentalized game where you go through a lot of the same places that are slightly different because they've been altered for the mission, or you go to a place kind of one time and there's just, as opposed to giving you like these subquests that you kind of ran into with the extra portrait ghost, there's like things hidden in the level. So there's hidden booze, there's these gemstones you can find if you wander around, stuff like that. From where I'm at this point, yeah, it's a cool game, but I kind of wish it was a little bit more exploration based, because a lot of times it feels like you're dropped in a place and there's one way to go, and you go that way, you get there, you catch a ghost, and then you get warped back out, only to get warped back in later. And it just feels like there's a lot of stop-start going on in this game. And I understand the reason for it is that it's a handheld game, and they figured they needed to be kind of compartmentalized so you can get these sort of handheld experiences. But really, if you're playing it straight through, it just feels like a lot of stopping and starting.
Yeah, I think you're not necessarily meant to play this game for hours at a time. But I actually have a complaint, a different complaint about the mission structure. I think the missions are a good length, but I take a lot of issue with the fact that you can only save between missions. So if you are halfway through a mission, sometimes they're, you know, 15, 20 minutes long, and you want to get out and do something else on your 3DS, I mean, you can always close it, right? But if you want to, let's say, go check your Street Pass Plaza or play a different game, God forbid, and then come back to it, you're going to lose your progress if you haven't actually finished that mission. And this was a problem. I mean, this is functionally a problem for me at PAX East, because I downloaded the game overnight when it came out, and then we still had a whole day at PAX left. And I'm trying to check street passes and maybe get in a little bit of Luigi in between. And it ended up being a real problem because I didn't have 20 minutes to sit down and play it all the way through. I was playing it kind of 5 minutes at a time. And I ended up, you know, it took half the day for me to get through the first mission, and then I could finally check my street passes. And it's just really annoying. Like, come on, guys, let me save whenever I want to. Why is this a problem over and over and over in first-party Nintendo games?
It did seem like a weird miss, too, considering the game is so structured towards the mobile, this handheld experience, where it seems like they already said, all right, this isn't going to be an exploration game. It's going to be, you know, a much more focused, progress-based game. But why the hell can't you save then? Because it seems like that if you're going to go that far, just go ahead and do the last step and just say, and you can get out whenever you want. It's fine.
Well, and to be fair, I think this is still an exploration-based game, but it's more micro exploration versus macro.
I guess.
So it's generally not about you trying to figure out where in the mansion do I go next, because typically there are only a few, at least based on the first mansion, that's all I've seen so far. It seems like you usually have, you know, only four or five different rooms you could possibly go to within a given mission.
Right.
So it's not so much about, geez, which room do I go to next? It's more about learning how to get from one room to the next, because sometimes there's secret passageways, different ways that you transfer from room to room. And then also within each room, you're exploring that room. You're checking all the different things in there, and you're trying to see what you can you manipulate with the tools that you have, and you're exploring for the ghosts. You're looking for the ghosts. It's still that kind of, secret treasure hunt of you trying to go around and find where the ghosts might be hiding. So, you know, I agree. I mean, it's certainly not this big kind of open mansion like you had in the first game. And I think that's probably a valid sacrifice.
Yeah, I don't know. It feels like it's less of an experience just sort of patrolling, because a lot of times you end up, you know, you see the same places a lot of times, or because you're only seeing like three or four rooms at a time, there's less of the like, whoa, where am I now kind of feeling you get as you walk around. It makes the whole world feel less connected. It feels like I'm not in a mansion, but I'm in a series of rooms that comprise parts of a mansion, and I may never actually be able to understand to go from here to here in the house is how it would work. Whereas what was really cool about Luigi's Mansion is that you were in this enormous house that had lots of, like, it was like the Winchester house. There are rooms that go nowhere. There are rooms that lead you to places that are utterly confusing. There's like doors that when you walk through them, you enter spaces that shouldn't be as big as they are, or are really insanely small, and you just kind of, there's, every door had something behind it that was going to be kind of surprising. Whereas a lot of times, this game, maybe you can only get to five places because it's literally sealed off the rest of the mansion, and you just can't get to it on that mission. Mm-hmm. It feels like it removes a lot of the ambiance of the game. I mean, it's nice that, I mean, the world obviously looks better than the GameCube game. There's some better sound. Luigi seems much more involved in the world he's in now. I mean,
yeah, Charles. This is, I think, maybe so far my favorite performance by Charles Martinet. I think he adds so much to this character, and the character and the characterization of Luigi, the way that he behaves in the game, which is animation and voice, but it adds so much to this experience, not just to the presentation, but the way that you play the game and the feeling that you get from it is, there's so much to it that is based on just purely the character. And really, if you think about it, at this point, I feel that that Nintendo and, you know, Next Level Games, to give them a lot of credit, the developer and Charles Martinet, I think have imbued more humanity and more personality and more actual character traits into Luigi than they ever have with Mario.
Oh yeah.
And I think as of today, and this may change by the end of the year, we'll see, but I think as of today, Luigi is the more interesting character. And it's, this game takes it to a whole new level because, you know, I mean, and the first game did too, to give it a lot of credit. You know, we played Luigi's Mansion on Retroactive a long time ago, and I think a lot of this stuff comes out of that game, but I think they've done a better job with it in Dark Moon, and they've really taken it to, you know, the level that you would want. And you just have to love Luigi playing this. I mean, he is so funny. He's so pathetic and cowardly, and yet he keeps on pushing through. And I think it's absolutely brilliant character work.
He's the most human Mario character at this point. Because
easily,
because anybody who's dropped in his third haunted mansion of the night is going to piss themselves. because Egad is such, or Professor Egad is such a nihilist at this point. He's like, you know what? I'm going to send you to another haunted mansion. Stop freaking out. You've been through three of these at this point. What's your problem?
He's almost a bully in this game.
He really is. I mean,
he's actually almost making fun of Luigi for being so cowardly.
There's a point in the game where he excoriates Luigi for not being as capable as he should be of rounding up these ghosts. Like, it just, like, he goes all the way into the deep heart of this mansion to rescue Egad's assistant, and he's like, seriously, it took you that long? What's your problem? Well, I sit here on my ass and do nothing. I mean, actually, my second favorite character in the game, and probably the best character so far, with the exception of Luigi, is the dog ghost that only shows up a handful of times, which seems like a real miss. Cause it's
older
actually,
pup.
Yeah, because it's actually kind of an amazing character, because Luigi, it interacts really well with Luigi. Luigi's terrified of it because it's a ghost, but at the same time, he's engaged with it because it's a dog. So there's this sort of dichotomy of like, he gets frustrated with it for the same reasons you'd get frustrated with the dog. Like it runs off with something it's not supposed to have. But at the same time, whenever it jumps out of crevices, he freaks out.
Yeah.
Like he knows it's there because he's been following it, but it still scares him half to death. And then he scolds it like he would scold a regular dog. It sort of gives the interaction from the two something to really go with, because all Luigi had to interact with in the first game, I mean, Egad pops up occasionally, but were the individual ghosts. And all the ghosts, these portrait ghosts, all had personalities. But Luigi was more subservient to whatever shtick that particular ghost had at that moment. So, you know, the baby ghost, for example, it cried a lot, and that was its shtick. It threw toys at you. It was petulant. It was immature. It was just really obnoxious. And Luigi occasionally reacted to that personality trait, but more or less, he was just freaked out because it's a ghost. But with the dog, he really actually embraces it because it's a dog. He apparently is fond of dogs, but not so much when they're dead. So he's got these weird contrasting reactions to this dog that can flip pretty much on a dime, which is kind of fun. It's a nice characterization of it. Like I said, I do wish it was in there more though, because when the game creates some of these really interesting characters, it never really lets them live. I mean, for lack of a better word. I mean, the one character I want to hear less from is Egad, because he's talking all the time.
And yeah, he calls a lot.
Constantly. And even in the third mansion, he's still calling all the time. I don't care. I get it. I need to open this door. You don't have to tell me. It's like he was really hands-off in the first game. He called, I don't know, 10, 15 times, and then you know, occasionally he'd pop up and be like, hey, this is a new area. You need to figure this stuff out. But here he's there all the time. He is omnipresent and omniscient. It is really freaky.
At least that ringtone is amazing.
It is.
I don't know if you've let it play all the way through, but it's really good.
It's the interesting part for me is actually that if you let the game sit for a while, I mean, Luigi hummed in the other game, but he like gets fully orchestral with his humming at some point. Like he just starts going off, and you're like, he's really trying to keep himself psyched up, isn't he? It's kind of amazing.
Yep, I think between Runner 2, which we're going to talk about soon, and Luigi's Mansion, I think Charles Martinet is having maybe the best year ever. And there's still a lot of Mario games coming
there's
out
a lot of Mario
in
left.
The year, so he's got his work cut out for him. But I think Luigi is his best character going right now. This is just a joy. And, you know, for whatever other problems I have with the game, which are few so far, I am enjoying it a lot. I just got to the first boss, and the first boss I think is pretty much bullshit. But based on the one boss in the first Luigi's Mansion, I'm not surprised, because the problem is that the mechanics in Luigi's Mansion are not really combat mechanics. And when you try to amplify one of these ghost encounters into a boss encounter, you're basically asking the player to do more with these mechanics than they're really designed for. And inevitably, it starts to require you to master certain aspects of what is ultimately a very sloppy kind of way to play the game. And it just doesn't really work for me. And I thought it was extremely annoying with the whole Mecha Bowser thing at the end of Luigi's Mansion. Even some of those more difficult portrait ghosts are kind of like mini bosses. And some of those are very, very irritating as well, because the controls in the gameplay just don't, you know, you can't evade while you're using the vacuum. And Luigi's very slow, and he can't jump, he can't dodge. And so when people start throwing things at you while you're trying to use the vacuum, you don't really have much choice except to let go, but then you have to restart the entire combat cycle over again by going and finding the ghost and putting your flashlight on him and starting the vacuum and pulling away. And it's just kind of irritating. You know, it's not really why I come to these games. For the most part, I'll say Luigi's Mansion Dark Moon, it seems to, at least early in the game, it seems to dispense with the actual ghost busting fairly quickly, as if to say, this is not really the main reason you're here. The actual act of getting the ghost, it's geared to feel satisfying, but it's also geared to happen quickly and let you move on to the next thing that you want to do. And the problem with the bosses is that they end up kind of stretching this out, and I don't have a whole lot of patience for it.
Some of the later ghosts that show up sort of lose that vibe. They either cover their eyes and you have to hit them at these really tight intervals.
Yeah.
Or there's just a lot of them and it's hard to get any one at any one time. They're sort of swarming you. Or they just have a ton of health. And
none of this is good news for me.
there are just some that have a lot of health and they just take a long time to get rid of. But
yeah. I would prefer that the act of finding them in the first place be the more interesting part. That's kind of where the puzzle comes in, right? The puzzle and the exploration. But like once you find the ghost, just let me put him away and then go on and do the next thing. Because the actual ghost busting is so simple that trying to make it challenging is inevitably just going to lead to frustration.
Yeah, but the majority of the ghosts really aren't hidden. Most of them ambush him versus the other way around, so they'd have to change that. And then, it wouldn't make sense for him to be actively seeking out the ghosts because he's more or less trying to avoid them to the best of his ability. I mean, there's some points where if you leave a room that still has ghosts in it to a room that doesn't, he basically sighs and has to sort of like, oh, thank God that's over.
I've seen that. That's really good. One thing you touched on, James, that I want to remark on before we move on is the lack of the second joystick.
Yeah.
And I've been thinking about this a lot because, we kind of found out in the past week or so that the game definitely does not support the Circle Pad Pro.
Right.
And it seems like, on the one hand, sure, there aren't that many people who even own one. But considering this game was literally a showcase for dual stick controls on GameCube, I mean, this was like Miyamoto saying, you're going to learn how to use two joysticks at the same time in order to play Luigi's Mansion. It seemed really weird that they wouldn't even provide it as an option in the sequel.
And see, now he's teaching you you're going to learn to use one joystick.
Well, actually, what I think they've done is they've just designed a more intelligent control scheme. And part of it is that they, in Dark Moon, they give you more things to do. So you have more tools at your disposal. And what that means is you need to have access to the face buttons while you're using the vacuum. And that wouldn't be possible if you were already also using your right thumb on a second joystick. So I think this has more to do with the design of the game and the kinds of mechanics they wanted to build into it than it does the fact that the standard 3DS only has one joystick, or that not very many people own the Circle Pad Pro, because they could have found ways around those issues. But ultimately, I think, and when I think back on it, I remember back in 2001, 2002, when Luigi's Mansion had first come out, a lot of people were actually complaining that it was hard to control, because they weren't used to that. And at the time, dual joystick controls were kind of a new thing. It hadn't been done in a whole lot of games up to that point. And as I look back on it, I think back to when we did it for Retroactive, I think, honestly, the ability to move in one direction and point the joystick or the vacuum or point the flashlight or the vacuum in a different direction is not really useful in Luigi's Mansion. They force you to do it, but they didn't have to. I think they forced you to do it just because they wanted you to kind of have to use both joysticks. But the thing is, once your vacuum latches onto something like a ghost, all you have to do is pull away in the other direction. You don't need two joysticks to do that. You're locked in. It's basically a lock-on mechanism, just like in Zelda. Once you lock on to the enemy or the object that you're sucking, Luigi, all his job is basically to back away and maybe move side to side to dodge something every now and then. So there's just no need for it. The only thing is the verticality. And this is it's a very three-dimensional game, and there are things that are above Luigi. There's never anything below because he doesn't jump.
Because it's the floor.
So there's only things above him. And so all they did was just let you push the X button to point the flashlight up or the vacuum up. And so then you can see up. So that's one button. They've taken care of functionality of an entire joystick with one button. And now you also have access to all those other buttons that let you use the dark light or let you engage the vacuum while you're pulling on a ghost to get an extra pull once you filled up the meter. All this other stuff that you can do that really wouldn't have been very feasible because there aren't enough shoulder buttons to do all that if you have both thumbs on joysticks. So I think it's actually the right decision. I'm surprised by that observation, but as I've played the game more, I now understand and respect what they've done here. And I think the game, I honestly think the game plays better with one joystick than the original did with two.
So the other thing they did, though, is they changed how flashlights work.
Yeah.
So before it was just, you just had to hit the ghost with the flashlight, and that was it. So mm-hmm. And so now you have to sort of flash them with it, which works fine.
By pushing a face button.
Yeah, it's a face button. It was, I don't know, it does take away a certain type of encounter they had in the first game, which is as you're walking, all of a sudden the flashlight hits a ghost that wasn't visible, and all of a sudden both you and Luigi go, ah! Where the fuck do you come from? Actually, you, the ghost, and Luigi all sort of do it, which was always to me one of the more fun moments of the game. The other thing the other thing they changed is they basically changed how to get rid of the non-ghost enemies, which is basically you hit them with the flashlight pulse, versus before where it was the vacuum.
Yeah,
you just sort of grab them up. You can still do that, but for whatever reason, the game doesn't give you a reward for vacuuming them, which is really odd.
Because you vacuumed up the reward.
But you vacuum up gold all the time, and it's great. It's fine. Everything's good. I don't know. It's really weird. I wonder if that was deliberate or they just kind of messed up. Because if you flash a gold mouse, for example, it spits out gold like you just broke into Fort Knox. Mm-hmm. But if you vacuum up, nothing. Which is actually the harder action to accomplish. So I wonder if that was deliberate or they just kind of messed up.
Yeah, that is kind of weird. All right, well, we've talked enough about it for 1 week. We'll probably come back to it another time, but that's Luigi's Mansion Dark Moon. I certainly would recommend it based on what I've played so far.
Yeah, I would. I just like I said, it just goes back to I just wish I could explore more. That's really all.
Yeah, it seems like it would be nice if they kind of offered a free play mode after you finish a mansion or maybe after you finish the game, and you could just roam through the whole thing at your leisure.
Especially if that's where they hid the booze. And you have to go find the booze now. Go find them. It would be.
Yeah,
it,
I don't like the booze being locked away to certain missions because that, I don't know. Yeah, something about that rubs me wrong.
Yeah, because all you know is I've got the boo for this level. It doesn't really help you that much finding them.
Right. Okay, so anyway, let's move on to Guillaume, who also has a brand new game to talk about.
Yeah, so I'm still playing, I'm pretty deep into Etrian Odyssey 4. And
is it too deep?
Well, yeah, it's a pretty long game, and I've said in the past that I didn't want to be buying too many games. I don't want to be overwhelmed, and I don't want to bite more than I can chew. But it turns out that all that accomplishes is that I miss out on a game when it launches, and then a week or two later, I give in and buy it anyway. So all this has accomplished so far is that I just end up talking about games a little bit later than other people are.
I know that feeling very well. It's probably going to be that way with Bioshock Infinite for me.
Yeah. So I've been playing LEGO City Undercover. I don't have a huge history with the LEGO games. I never bought any of them, but I've played parts of Harry Potter with my girlfriend, and they're fun games, but I could see that they weren't really for me. There was something about the way that they just asked you to perform this random task, perform this other random task, put three books on three bookshelves or light up three candles. It seemed basic, I suppose, and not terribly fun. I think most of the fun came from playing co-op. But I still wanted to give LEGO City Undercover a shot because I do like open world games. I've played quite a few of them, and I think the trailers convinced me that the game would be funny enough to be engaging.
He wanted to go on a crime spree as a LEGO figure, essentially. Brick on brick violence.
But yeah, so I think that LEGO games have had a lot of criticism for being kind of collectathons, and I was kind of worried that, because that's a feature of open world games as well, they often devolve into find this many feathers, no matter how little sense it makes in Assassin's Creed 2, find 100 feathers. So I was kind of wondering, wow, are they going to double down on collecting? And is it just going to become so tedious that I'm going to give up very quickly? It turned out that now the collecting in LEGO games kind of makes more sense. It feels more at home, and the collecting is actually addicting instead of being tedious. You know, you explore more and more of the map, and you can see, like, right in the corner of your eye, oh, okay, there's, like, this golden brick, I should try to get it. And you get there, and, okay, I see another thing at distance, I think I'm gonna go grab it. And it just goes on and on like that, and it's very fun, it's very addicting.
You think it's the open world architecture that sort of salvages that?
Yeah, I think it helps, and I think also that the, you know, the blocks are perhaps like a little bit more in the open. In the little bit of Harry Potter that I played, like you had to accomplish very obscure tasks, you know, that didn't really make sense. There's still some of that in this game, but for the most part, you know, it's just like climb this building, you're going to find something on top, and climb this other building, and you're going to find something on top. And the platforming can be pretty engaging, pretty involved. If you've seen the trailers, you can see that, like, your guy Chase McCain can swing from poles and climb up walls and just do all sorts of acrobatic stuff. That's very, very fun. That's a big part of what I enjoy in the game. And as the story, I would say, is not quite as funny as I expected. Like, a lot of the jokes fall flat, and there's a lot of the humor that just, it seems to come from, like, the Family Guy or Scary Movie kind of school of humor, where it's just like, hey, like, look at this reference. We're referencing it. Huh? Lego?
It's kind of treading the same ground as Hot Fuzz, but maybe a lot more obvious about it, I guess.
Hot Fuzz actually has jokes about the references, though. Like, this is more like in the, like, the worst scary movies. Like, perhaps you haven't watched them. I wouldn't blame you. Like, there's no punchline to the jokes. Like, it's just a reference. And the game opens up, you know, like, you come to Lego City on a boat. You're in a boat? Okay, let's put, like, Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet Lego figures just doing the whole I'm king of the world thing.
Well, I mean, that's really what a lot of the Lego games did, though. It's like, oh, look, it's the penguin. He's got penguin following him. Isn't that funny? And then you punch him in the head. I mean, he's really no different than anything else. You just punched him in the head until he blew up into Legos.
I guess. I haven't played the other Lego games, so I guess I was expecting a little bit more than that. Like, it's literally just like, okay, we're going to have these two Lego figures, you know, enact the scene from Titanic, and, oh, look, they're falling in the water. That's a joke, you know? So that's not too good. But there's also some bits of dialogue that's genuinely funny. Like, there's probably, I don't think you'll ever find a cuter Dirty Harry reference than in this game. You know, like, you've got, like, a cop asking the guy next to him, hey, Callahan, how many cups of coffee have you had? And, you know, the other answers, I know what you're thinking. Has he had 6 shots of coffee? Only 5. It's cute stuff like that probably kids won't get at all, but it's enough.
Dude, I don't even get that.
Really?
Yeah, really. I've never seen Dirty Harry.
Oh, the whole, do you feel lucky, punk? You know,
I know that quote.
Okay, well, he doesn't get to the punk part, I guess. So I guess the reference is less than a lot of people.
That's not PC.
Like, I know that from The Mask.
Oh. Nice. All right, let's move on. Next game.
Yeah.
You have poisoned the water so badly at this point.
Me?
Cannot proceed. No, not you.
Oh.
You're not the one referencing The Mask in reference to a Lego game. At this point, we just pull the ejector
Lego seats. The Mask. Bring it.
We'll be back for listener mail.
Actually, like, the mask reference is probably appropriate because the writers of this game seem to be stuck in 1999, because not only is there a Titanic reference, there's, like, a Matrix reference. There's a lot of... There's a Shawshank Redemption reference.
Does your Lego character crawl through a tube of shit? Is that what happens?
Unfortunately, no. But you've got, like, this character, Blue, who's clearly red from, you know, the Morgan Freeman character. It's really not subtle at all. And no kid would get those references. And they're only mildly amusing for adults. So I kind of wonder.
Yeah, I could kind of understand it if they were going for, like, a dual audience Pixar type thing, you know, because people do play Lego games with their kids. Mm. So that there might actually be a, you know, a really good argument for putting in jokes for multiple age brackets, but if they're not really funny for the adults, then that doesn't work.
Yeah, the I guess that the they're going more for a cute tone to the game than an actually haha funny tone. Like, there's something very the world of Lego City is so nice. I kind of want to download my consciousness into the game and live there. I want to have an apartment in Lego City. Like, everything is so squeaky clean. Everything is so nice. I mean, like, the criminals, like, you're in the middle of a crime wave, but the criminals are just pranksters. It's basically like 60s Batman. No one dies. No one gets hurt. You know, it's just like, when you visit the prison, actually, like, you're in the middle of inmates, you're in your, you know, you're a cop, but they don't attack you. They're just like, you know, shouting, "You can't keep me inside, not when it's sunny outside," you know, like, they're just, it's so freaking clean. Anyway, like, it's it's very cute, and I kind of love that. Like, I guess I like the way that the game is not cynical at all, and, you know, it's just... It's,
sure, yeah.
How do I finish? I guess that's it. Lego City Undercover. It's very nice.
So, cool. So I'll go up next. Rather than talk about a new game, I've been kind of still playing a lot of Vita stuff and Luigi, a lot of Street Pass. Oh my gosh, a lot of Street Pass. I hit 20 hours in Ni No Kuni. But I'm kind of on maintenance through a lot of games. I'm actually just trying to finish a few things so I can play some new games. So I thought I would talk about some stuff I played at PAX East. And we talked a little bit about it on a bonus segment for Connectivity that I'll plug later. But I think not all of these made it in there. So you guys stop me if you remember me doing this before. But let's start with Tokitori 2. Oh my God. Tokitori 2.
I have the review copy for the game.
Good. Tokitori 2, it will be coming out a few days after this episode goes up, so it's very, very close now. Game's been, I mean, it was announced a long time ago. I think it was one of the first Wii U games ever announced. And it's the sequel to Tokitori, which was originally on Game Boy Color. Then they remade it on WiiWare. And even the WiiWare version came out, I don't know, 5-6 years ago, it seems like.
Yeah.
No.
It was
maybe 5.
Wasn't it like in the first batch of WiiWare games?
Yeah. It was pretty close to the WiiWare launch. So that would be 5 years ago almost. Mm. A long time ago. So I remember when Tokitori 2 was announced, I'm thinking, does the world really care about Tokitori 2? I mean, do we really need more Tokitori? Like, I enjoyed the WiiWare game a lot. I also found that it was there was almost too much of it. In other words, rather than kind of end the game at a graceful point where you felt like you'd really seen everything that it had to offer and had really kind of reached a logical conclusion, it kept on going. And then they unlock a whole second quest of really hard levels, and that the game just got insanely difficult, and I never finished it. And I bet you most people never finished. I bet I played more of it than most people did.
I really liked the game, but I didn't unlock any second quest, so yeah, I didn't finish it either.
It's certainly a good value if you're really good at puzzle games, but Tokitori was just really hard. Very cute game, but very difficult. So Tokitori 2, I didn't know very much about it, and I kind of expected just a really direct follow-up to the last one, you know, just basically more levels. We'll make it look nicer with, you know, high-definition polygonal characters. No. Tokitori 2, it's actually not even a good name for it because it is so different from Tokitori that I think just putting a 2 at the end does it a disservice. So this game is entirely 2D artwork, very high resolution, looks fabulous. I mean, it looks really, really, really good.
Well, the first game really looked good for WiiWare, but this just takes it to another level. And it's probably one of the most colorful games on the Wii U. And it's, you know, already there's a lot of colorful games on the platform. So it's a treat.
Yeah, I think if you're a fan of WayForward's art style, this will really appeal to you. I think Tokitori 2 actually looks better than WayForward stuff, in my opinion. It may not be quite as lavishly animated, but I like the art style better, and it looks cleaner to me. The other thing about it is that they've actually changed the mechanics a lot. So you're still controlling this fat little bird, and he kind of waddles left and right. He can't jump. He can climb up ladders, and he can drop off of things and kind of float down safely, but he can't jump. So you have to find other ways of getting up and down. And in the last game, he could like create blocks in thin air and then push blocks around. And pretty much all that stuff is gone. All those mechanics are gone. So he still can't jump in this game. But instead, they've boiled everything down into two buttons, basically. You push one to whistle, which has the effect of attracting enemies towards you in general. And sometimes it does other things. You can also use the whistle. You can kind of play it like a Morse code. So you could do kind of short notes and long notes and create little patterns of them that form songs, just like in, let's say, Ocarina of Time. You can create these little songs of the whistle pattern, and then those songs have magical effects. Sometimes they let you warp back to your last checkpoint. They might do all kinds of things, and you can even do them on the world, on the overworld map.
Yeah, and you can do them from like at any point in the game, even before you learn the songs. Like if you already know what you're doing, like if you already know the tunes, you can do them from the very beginning. And so like no ability is locked in a game. Like you don't acquire new abilities later on.
Right.
You have everything at your disposal right away. It's just a matter of learning how to use it.
Yeah, and you do learn songs as you go. So there'll be little birds in the environment who will, you know, you'll get into an area with them and they'll whistle a song and the notes will appear on the screen and they will teach you how to do that song. But the truth is you could always do it. Yeah. They're just kind of revealing it to you. So you can actually just kind of experiment right from the very beginning and maybe find songs that the game hasn't told you yet that let you do really interesting things. So that's very interesting, very cool. And actually there's an old PC adventure game called Loom that works a very similar way. I don't know how many people will get that reference, but I know one guy who will.
Ask me about Loom.
Yeah. The other mechanic is that you can stomp. And stomp has the effect of generally pushing enemies away from you, other animals, other enemies.
Yeah, it's just a reverse of tweet, essentially.
It's not the exact reverse. It does other things, too. But anyway, singing and stomping, those are the things you can do in this game. And even within a 10-minute demo, it's kind of shocking how many different things they're able to pull together with just those two actions. And primarily because most of the game seems to center around interacting with the animals around you. Sometimes they're enemies, sometimes they're maybe more friendly types animals, but there's all these things in the environment. And these two actions that you have, although they're very simple and they never change, the reactions of everything around you change as you go through the game. And learning how to predict and control those reactions and then use them to your advantage is how you solve the puzzles and ultimately get through the levels and find the secret things. And it gave me this weird vibe of almost like a Wario Land 2 or Wario Land 3, because it's not really a platformer. It's not really about surviving. You know, there's no combat. It's not about, it's more about puzzle solving. It's more about using the enemies around you to get from one place to another. And I was so impressed by what I saw. And this game went from basically being totally off my radar to probably one of my most anticipated Wii U games right now. Very, very, very cool demo. And it's coming out really soon. So yeah, I think you should look forward to it.
Like I played the demo and I went through the main path, I guess you would call it. And there was a point where you're in tall grass and there's this kind of owl thing that usually would swoop down and pick you up and bring you up to its nest. And it's all incredibly cute. But in this case, since I was in tall grass, it wouldn't see me. So I couldn't figure out how to make it see me. I now have the review copy. So I managed to figure that out this time. So I haven't even gone through the path that I played in the demo. I'm now on an entirely different path. So nice. That's very, very cool.
Yeah. Yeah, that game looks super impressive. So that was a real nice surprise. Maybe much less of a surprise is I got to play a little bit of, I didn't really play it. I guess I just saw Deus Ex Human Revolution on Wii U. And I don't want to say much about it because we have, impressions up on the site already that Scott and I co-wrote. Scott Thompson wrote most of it. I wrote a paragraph about the boss battles because I saw a separate demo about what they've done with that. Just to sum things up very quickly and hopefully entice you to go read the content on our website, I will say that it is still basically the same game. They are putting what I would consider an impressive amount of effort into trying to improve the game and also just add a lot of cool new content. The developer commentary is probably one of the most exciting things. There's also this weird, I mean, really brilliant, but certainly unexpected, built-in game fact that you can pull up at any time. It's kind of the super guide taken to the extreme level. It is literally like the best guide you've ever read on game facts, built directly into the game, written by the people who made the game. It knows where you are. It goes straight to your current location. It gives you multiple ways of getting through whatever situation you're in, depending on how you want to play the game. It has maps. It's interactive. You can even cheat and just have it bring up the passcodes for you rather than try to hack them or go look for them. You can use it as much as you want. There's no penalty for it. If you don't want to use that, if you just want to find your way through it, go ahead. But in reality, almost no one plays through Deus Ex Human Revolution without getting some kind of help from a guide. So I think just go ahead and building that in is extremely convenient. You can look at it all on the gamepad while you play the game, of course. And it saves you going back and forth to your computer or having to pull something up on your phone and read it on a little screen. I think it's genius. And it's the kind of thing I was not expecting at all. Also, the game is over 2 years old, so you're not going to spoil anything. I mean, if you wanted to find these guides, you could go do it anyway. So I think just putting it right in there and making it easy to use is a really lovely touch. And, you know, it's probably the best looking console version of the game for at least 6 months. Because I expect that this director's cut will probably be one of the first games to come out on the new Xbox and PlayStation, just because it gives them something to play on in the early days, and most of the work has already been done for the Wii U version. But if you've never played the game, it certainly seems like an excellent version of it. I think it's a great game. I would be very cautious as to what they price it at, because this is, to me, not a $60 package, not when the game itself can be had for $10 brand new, the original game. So I don't think what they've added to it is $50 worth, but I think it's really neat. And, and I feel a lot less cynical about the whole thing after seeing just how much they've done to it. So anyway, you can read more details on the site about that. I didn't get to play, unfortunately, but I got to see a lot of Shovel Knight, which is an indie game that just got kickstarted.
I've played this.
You did? Okay, you got to play it. So,
yeah.
To me, it looks heavily like a Mega Man game, an 8-bit retro Mega Man game. But it seems to maybe have some elements of DuckTales as well.
The pogo stick move is really taken from DuckTales. You just hold the jump button and down, and the Shovel Knight just uses his shovel as a pogo stick. It's the same exact feeling.
To me, as someone who has extensive experience with the Mega Man franchise, it's the first game that somebody said, oh, it's like Mega Man, that I actually felt had the speed, at least of an early Mega Man game. Mm-hmm. A lot of times those games end up being really slow, and I complained about this with Gunman Clives. It's just too damn slow.
Sure.
This game actually has pace to it, where the character moves at some amount of speed, and that speed factors into the combat, where you have to be relatively faster.
Yeah, you've got enemies that just charge at you right away when they see you, and you have to use them to, like, you have to use your pogo stick move as they charge at you. Like, you have to see them coming and use them as a platform to launch yourself to higher places where you'll find, like, treasure chests and things like that.
Yep. That's what I want.
Yeah, it's very, very old school. It's very, very simple, too. Like, I mean, you're really getting kind of an NES era action game. Like the game basically uses two buttons. No matter how many buttons there are on the controller, it still uses just two. I made it to a point where I got a spell. Like I could fire from a distance, a fireball. You hold up and press B. You know?
Nice.
So it's that kind of game.
I mean, to me, normally when I hear these kinds of like, oh, it's like a Mega Man game, I'm kind of turned off instantly because I expect it to feel junky in some way, and having played it, I'm still I went from having no interest in this game whatsoever because of that visceral reaction that kicks in as soon as someone drops the Mega Man phrase, to having some level of excitement and thinking about buying the game right now via the Kickstarter, because they still have a long way to go on their financial goals.
Oh, really?
Okay. And if you, they're still at least 10,000 out from their target.
Okay.
And if you give them $15, you can get a 3DS or Wii U version of the game when it comes out.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
If you give them 10, you get a PC version, but why the fuck would you want to play a Mega Man game on the PC?
Yeah, good question. Anyway, I thought it looked fantastic. Just visually, they have nailed the NES graphics chip. And it really does look like a Mega Man game in the color palette and the level of detail on the characters. I think the character design of the Shovel Knight is really funny. And he looks like a Mega Man boss, but you get to play as him in this game. It's goofy. It just looks really fun.
And very quickly, since we've already made the DuckTales comparison, there is a new DuckTale game coming out, DuckTales Remastered. I haven't played it, but I've seen someone play the demo. Mm-hmm. The game is constantly interrupted by cutscenes, in-engine cutscenes. Like, you have to watch...
But they have the original voice actors!
Yeah, well, you know, like, that... Yeah. That's not... I don't remember the NES original for its cutscenes, and so
it did have them. I don't know if they're expanding them in the remake, but the original game did have cutscenes. It had mostly at the beginning and the end.
They seemed quite intrusive in just like the 5 minutes that I saw.
Okay, well, the part I saw didn't have any, so it might have just been the part of the level that you were on.
Anyway, just because of that experience watching DuckTales Remastered and playing Shovel Knight, I kind of look forward to Shovel Knight more. I'm like, this is the true spiritual successor to DuckTales.
Yeah, DuckTales Remastered, I mean, it is a remake of the first of the original DuckTales NES game, but they are adding new content also, and they are trying to bring it into a more modern presentation. And there are pros and cons to that, and you know, there are ways to mess that up. So hopefully they're going to get it right. I thought it looked very good, and it seemed to play at the correct speed and everything, which was encouraging because DuckTales is a fast game. It's a hard game, and I know they're putting in a lot of difficulty settings, so you can kind of choose if you want to make it easier than the original or even harder. But DuckTales has a very special place in my heart. It was the first video game I ever finished. And I played a ton of it, and I haven't touched it in 20 years. So I'm really excited for that remake. And that's coming to Wii U also.
Mm-hmm.
Another game that is probably coming to, let's see, I think they said probably to 3DS, but Wii U is not out of the question either. Anyway, it's called Dragon Fantasy. This is an indie RPG that has been out for a year or so, I think, on PC. They are finishing up Dragon Fantasy II right now, and that's going to be exclusive for a while on PS3 and Vita. But at the same time, they're also doing kind of a remastered, upgraded version of the first Dragon Fantasy, since most console players never got to play it. And they're releasing that also on the Sony platforms. And then that version of one, then they're going to port it to other stuff, including 3DS. So that's probably going to be coming out towards the end of the year, it sounded like. But I wanted to bring this up just because I think it looks really interesting. It's almost kind of like a neon Chrono Trigger. So it has that sort of level of detail in the characters, very much a 2D kind of over, you know, from the top RPG. But it has a little bit more of a psychedelic color scheme to it. I don't know much about it. I played it for a few minutes. I know there's an interesting thing. It is kind of an evolution of the system in Chrono Trigger where, you would see the enemies on the map, and then when you went up to them, the battle would just start, right? And sometimes more enemies would rush in from off the screen that you couldn't see before, and then you'd have to fight them too.
I was gonna say, to give them a recent example, it's kind of like 2D Xenoblade, where the enemies are on the map, and they get drawn in by the fighting.
Yeah. So in Dragon Fantasy, all the enemies are already laid out, and depending on what sort of angle you approach them from, or that they attack you from, more enemies can actually be added to the fight as it goes on, depending on what order you kill them and the way the camera moves around. So I thought that was kind of neat. I'd never seen anything quite like that. But it looks really interesting. And, I might end up getting the Vita version just because I have a feeling they might sell one and two as a package and I might get a deal on them. But if not, I might wait and go ahead and get it on 3DS later. But it looks really cool. I mean, it's a 2D, kind of 16-bit style RPG.
But is it like kind of a like a self-aware parody, because Dragon Fantasy is the most generic name you could think of. Like, it sounds like a joke.
Yeah, I don't know the kind of style of humor or the style of writing of it, because it was a convention demo for an RPG. Yeah. So those are just kind of famously really hard to do. But yeah, they're big Nintendo fans, and they definitely want these games to come out on Nintendo systems. So I think that's something to look forward to. On a similar vein, something I didn't get to spend as much time with, there was a game called Two Brothers. And you might have heard about this. It's supposedly inspired heavily by Earthbound, but it actually, if you've seen screenshots of it, it looks like a black and white Game Boy game, except way higher resolution. It looks really nice. And apparently, as you play through the game, you actually kind of proceed from black and white Game Boy style graphics to 8-bit and then eventually to 16-bit. So I haven't seen the later stuff, but that sounds really interesting. And I don't know a whole lot about it, but I think it is more of a kind of an action RPG, kind of like Secret of Mana or Zelda. So I don't know that it has turn-based battles or not, but I saw very little of it. I know Neil got to play it, and he's probably going to be writing about it, or maybe talking about it on Connectivity pretty soon. But that looked pretty cool. That's coming to Wii U by the end of this year. And one more, just because I know a few people will be interested in this, I got to sort of play the new first-person shooter from Renegade Kid called Colt County.
It
was what they called sort of a non-interactive atmosphere demo. It really was interactive. You could control it. They actually had a Circle Pad Pro, and that was the first time I'd used one of those. But so I'm moving with one joystick, and you know, I can look around with the other one as I move around. And I was holding a wrench, I think, and I could push a face button or a shoulder button to swing the wrench.
But
there's nothing to swing it at. It's just an environment. You can walk around, look at the graphics, which looked very good. There's some really nice particle effects with blowing sand in front of you.
It was like the Dust Bowl, really.
Very dusty. And the environment was sort of the grounds outside of an old church. There were no people around. You couldn't go in the church. You couldn't do anything except walk around.
Except hit the church with the wrench, basically.
But it looked good.
Yeah.
The music, I actually plugged in my headphones. It was loud on the show floor, but I got to plug in my headphones. Music was super creepy. So I think you can tell they're definitely going back to their days of doing Dementium 1 and 2 on DS. They're going for that really, you know, kind of horror game vibe. You know, the whole vibe of it did the atmosphere, which is what the demo was supposed to do. It kind of reminded me of Red State, or maybe even, I don't know, Tremors, maybe even From Dusk Till Dawn.
Really?
You know, that kind of a vibe to it. So, and I like all that stuff. So, I think this might actually appeal to me more than Dementium did. But it's interesting to see them have so much success with Mutant Muds, a 2D platformer. And then kind of go back to this with newer hardware and see what they're able to do with it. Looks really impressive, but it's as it is right now, what we have seen of it and played of it, it's very hard to say what the gameplay is really like. It was more of an engine demo, but it's an impressive engine. So you can look forward to learning more about that. I think that's not coming until next year though. So it's a ways out. Let's see, we're sitting in an hour. Guy, you've been holding on to Runner 2 for a few weeks already. Why don't you go ahead and talk about that for a few minutes?
Yeah, well, I'm actually not that far into Runner 2. I've been waiting because it's one of the games that my girlfriend likes, so I'm kind of waiting on her.
How far are you? Because I may actually be further than you.
Oh, I just beat the second boss.
Oh, yeah, I'm actually further than...
I am too.
I've just been holding off, you know, just waiting because we play it together. We alternate, we each do one level.
That's awesome.
So it's it's such a funny game. I really, really wish that we lived in a world where there were more games like Runner 2 that dared to just be goofy and funny and fun, because I would be in heaven. Like I would be ecstatic if more games had a button that made Command Girl Video do the pony for like a split second while she's running, you know, like the dance.
And you get bonus points for doing that.
Yep, you get bonus points. But just like, I can't believe that a game so that had so little animation to speak of, the first runner game, spawned this game where there's just so many different animations for so many different characters. Like they clearly had to hire someone, and that someone was an animator and a very talented one at that. It's just so much fun just to mess around with, and it actually makes me laugh out loud. Like just the stupid moves that you can pull off in that game. Other than that, yeah, like it's more runner. It's more like they've made a lot of actions more complex. Now you kind of you have to do several actions at once. Like I think that back when you talked about it a couple of months ago, Johnny, you talked about the crouching and then jumping.
Yeah.
But in addition to that, you can also have to jump and kick or crouch and kick. And,
right.
After a while, it starts messing up with your head. Like there are parts where you have to grind a rail, but you can also press down and then you're hanging from the rail. So you have to be careful, avoid, you know, obstacles above and below the rail. And you might end up pressing down twice by mistake and then you'll fall off because that makes you let go of the rail, you know. Like it's just, there's so much more to keep track of in this game. It's a lot of fun. I really enjoy it. The music is better. It's so much better this time around. It's not just, well, yeah, like I there are parts, especially when you hit like the ultra level where the music just gets the right amount of instruments.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very, very satisfying. The bleeps and bloops of Runner, the first Runner, were fine, but they didn't really live up to the promise of the theme song, in my opinion.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, like they never got as complex, or they never got... Like, I think the theme song had, like, guitar to it, right? Like, it had...
Yeah.
Actual instruments in addition to the electronic stuff.
Yeah, that sounds right, because it was done by Anamanaguchi.
Right.
Whereas the music during the actual stages was written in-house, and it was really just kind of pure chiptune music.
Right.
Yeah. So this game is probably, like, the music is not, as far as I know, written by Anamaguchi, but it is more, like, it has more actual instruments to it.
Wait, chiptunes really wouldn't make sense in the context of this game.
No.
Right, yeah, because they've left behind that 8-bit sort of vibe to it. Now, I think, to me, the first world, the presentation, like, graphically, you know, it is HD now. There's a lot more animation. Even in the backgrounds, everything's animated. And the music does have a very different feel for it. And I have to say, in the first world, it wasn't working for me very well. The second world, where you go into the more marine, you know, you're kind of running on all these boardwalks and everything has more of an ocean kind of a theme to it, started to work for me a little better. Then I got to the third world, which is called the Supernature, and the music and the graphical presentation are heads and shoulders above anything from the first world. So from what I can tell, and I'm only in the third world now, but from what I can tell, the game's getting better as I get through it. And I just want to throw that out there in case anyone starts playing this game. And if you're not totally won over by the style of it, because there were definitely times in the first world where I kept thinking, you know, I kind of wish they had just done all of this in the style of the first game, because I thought it was more charming. Stick with it, because I think they find other ways to use the assets and the resources that they had in this new engine. And it starts to pull together a lot better, in my opinion, as you get farther in the game.
Mm. I just want to say, though, like I'm going to end this on a sour note, but there are a couple of design decisions that I find really weird. Stuff that I didn't expect from Gaijin games. I mean, there's a lot constantly when you're playing the game, you're going to get achievements pop up, and it's going to be the bad kind of achievements where it's like, oh, you've jumped 200 times. You've jumped 300 times,
mm-hmm.
You've jumped 500 times, and it doesn't add anything to the game. It almost feels like a joke, but not a very good one. Like, almost like a statement about achievements, but if it is, like, that's been done before, and better, and I don't think it really has a place in the game. And similarly, like, there's three difficulty levels to the game. Like, you can at any time just press one of the shoulder buttons and you can switch from easy to normal to hard.
Mm-hmm.
And you get kind of an icon that pops up every time that you complete a level with each of them. But if you beat a level on hard, you still have to go back and do it at the easy and normal modes if you want to get those icons. So it's kind of a nightmare for...
Why do you want all those icons?
Well, I guess you don't. And that's what I've decided. But
yeah,
that's the thing. Like, I am a big fan of this series. I'm a big fan of this developer. And I don't want to 100% their game. It's weird to me that they chose to create the game that way.
This isn't even a design thing. It's just that you're complaining about that there's a symbol that pops up on the screen if you change difficulty.
Well, it's also part of the achievement system, right? Like, it's like, a triple exclamation mark rating on this many levels.
Okay, I didn't know that. I also don't care, I guess. But there's so much content in this game. There's so many secret things. There's so many optional things that you can do that are sometimes hidden, sometimes very obvious.
Right.
Many reasons to go back and play levels over and over again. You don't really need... being a completionist and solving it every single way that you possibly can, every single permutation, you really don't need to go to that extent to get a lot of great value out of this game. And I guess my message to you and to our listeners is have some willpower. I mean, don't be such a slavish completionist that you feel like you have to do every single thing that's packed into the game.
But I don't. My point is that it seems superfluous. Like, it seems like it's a mistake to have done that in the first place.
Maybe some person really wants that. I mean, I don't know that it's a mistake. It's
There's probably like 1% of the audience who wants to, you know, beat every level 10 different ways and get all the little icons and get every single bit of credit that they can from the developer. But that's not a normal playthrough. I'm taken aback. This is just an odd complaint. But
you're an odd complaint.
I will try to sympathize better. Sorry, Guillaume. Anyway, Runner 2 is actually really great. I hope you guys are checking it out.
It is great.
For me, what's weird about this game, and I don't quite understand how it works. I mean, I get the psychology of it, but this is in that weird subset of games where... as I play, I become increasingly unaware of what I'm doing. I become more and more... I mean, trance really is the best word for it. It becomes more of a trance state. I can't tell you what buttons I just pressed. But my hand knows, and my eyes know. But everything in between has become mechanical. There's no thought process going on at all, effectively. It's just...
Do you find that pleasant?
I find it kind of weird when I'm done. Like, after I stop playing, I don't feel like it stuck with me because I wasn't processing what was going on. It was just, it's a very odd experience to come out of. And
yeah,
I mean, when I say it's like trance, it really is like being in a trance state. I mean, because really, the brain more or less shuts off at that point. It's just, it's along for the ride as much as your feet are at that point. It's a very weird experience to find yourself in.
Yeah,
I guess my
if I
want to try to define my problem with like what they did with the game, and I think
that
it's a little
turn,
bit
Johnny, you did this. You could have let me talk about Auto Modelista, but this is where we ended up.
No, but like there seems like they tried to do perhaps too much. Like, the game is not as focused as the original. Like, you have alternate paths. You have secrets, like secret costumes. You've got keys. You have to unlock the keys. You've got secret levels. You've got three different difficulty levels. You've got leaderboards.
Mm-hmm.
And like, when you pile that, you know, and you've got, you know, retro levels, and like, it just piles on and on and on. And at a certain point, like, I just don't know what to focus on.
Okay. I think that's fair. Yeah.
You know, like, do I try to compete with friends for the leaderboards, then I kind of have to play the game on easy and ignore everything else that the game has to offer. I just have to mash the dance button.
Oh no, their scores are in the hard section because there's more things to jump over and avoid and more points to collect. I mean, almost all of my high scores are dominated by Patch Kid from the forums.
Right,
that would be Patrick Barnett.
Yeah, that's true.
Right.
It is,
on our staff.
It is. Now, I forget that. I apologize.
Yeah.
Sorry, Patrick. Yeah.
Anyway.
He owns my high score board.
Anyway, I think I would have preferred perhaps a more tightly designed game. Like it seems to me like it's going in a lot of different directions at once, and it makes it hard to figure out how I want to play the game. It's a weird thing to say, but it's
That's how I feel. I think that's valid, actually. But it's also the kind of thing a lot of people are going to appreciate that. I think a lot of people probably like the game more because it has all this hidden stuff and because it has optional paths. It has a lot of optional difficulty. You can choose, in a lot of cases, just how hard you want to make it on yourself. You can jump over and skip the checkpoint for extra points if you care more about points than you do about finishing the level. But I would say also that stuff means you can sort of power through the whole game once and just take the path of least resistance and just... I just want to go through this and see everything there is to see. And then if you want, you can go back, and there's lots of reasons to go back and replay the levels. I think they're just trying to kind of fill it up with value. But there is a sense, and this is how I feel about most open world games. It's funny to hear you talk about it in this context, but the way I feel about Lego games and GTA games is that there's usually too much content, and they don't do a good enough job of sort of directing you down the path. And what if I just want to play this through and make it confusing to do that? In Runner 2, I mean, you are looking at basically a Super Mario 3 kind of overworld map, you know, node to node. So if you're obsessing about playing a level over and over and over again before you move on, then I could see it being a problem. But you could also just, let me just get to the end of this, unlock the next level, I'll move on to that. Maybe I'll come back later and look for all the retro secret levels.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
Ultimately, it's up to you, because they give you so much freedom in how you want to play the game. It's up to you to decide which way do you like best, and don't drive yourself crazy.
I usually, like, my play style is that I try to play a game the optimal way the first time around, you know, just because I don't want to have to do it again.
So it drives you crazy when there's not a clearly optimal way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep. I do sympathize with that, because I used to feel the same way. And I kind of had to train myself out of it, because I started to expand my horizons and the kinds of games I was playing. I started to get into games where it's just not possible to play it optimally. Or it's not feasible.
Like every game John likes, the only way to play it optimally is not play.
Boom! Well, that's the thing. Sometimes I choose that path of least resistance. I don't want that to happen with Runner 2.
I think Matthew Broderick would agree. So, we're going to have to wrap up new business and avoid thermonuclear warfare. And when we come back, we're going to have your listener mail.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
First up this week, we have impressions for Mushikera Senshi on the 3DS eShop by Danny Bivens. What did Kenji Inafune do now that he's not Capcom's work slave anymore? Making a game for Guild Zero 2, where you are a member of a panzer unit that somehow ended up in Pikmin's giant bug universe. Seriously. We also have a very special treat for RFN fans. It's a surprise blog called Castlevania Lords of Subspace Emissary of Fate by Mr. Greg Leahy.
What?
Oh goodness, Greg wrote something, and it turns out when he looks into the Mirror of Fate, he sees reflections of Masahiro Sakurai's Subspace Emissary. You must read this article. Go there now.
Or die.
We have a review of Wild Adventures Ultimate Deer Hunt 3D. For the 3DS.
That's a lot of name.
By Patrick Barnett. Arcade shooting the hell out of nature in 3D is about as exciting as skunk hunting. You still get to shoot stuff, but you're not going to want to make a hat out of it.
Skunk hat.
And we have another review, Harmonite, for the 3DS eShop by Tyler Olu. Take one part the Trip Runner, add a dash of Pokemon Whimsy, and developers, and then make it awesome, you get Harmonite. Clunky name aside, this game is awesome. And please look for my Tokitori 2 impressions that I wrote for the site, myself, Guillaume Veillet. You can read pretty much what I just said on this podcast, except that I go in excruciating detail about the puzzles that you have to solve. Enjoy!
You might want to call it pleasant and wonderful detail to read for your own well-being.
That's right.
Yes.
We have a review mini of Christmas Wonderland 2 for the DSiWare by Zach Kaplan. Who doesn't love seasonal hidden item games on DSiWare? Everyone, of course. Christmas Wonderland 2 is more like Santa took a big old dump of coal in your sock. Lastly, we have a review of Luigi's Mansion 2 on 3DS by Don Koopman. Oh, Luigi, you so crazy, getting lost in all these haunted houses and running around with vacuums on your back. You need a better real estate agent. But hey, at least you're in one of the best games on 3DS. That's something.
That's right. And of course, we've also got some blogs and photo galleries from PAX East that are really fun, worth checking out. I took a video of some amazing players of Johann Sebastian Joust that I think you should watch. And you will find all of this content and our PAX East coverage and the latest news and all kinds of other stuff over at NintendoWorldReport.com. Welcome back, everyone. It's time for listener mail. The address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And we have some fun emails for you this week. Actually have even more sitting in the bag, so we're going to try to catch up soon. But we're going to get through at least three of these today, and James has the first one.
Rob from Delaware, Ohio writes, clearly there is a relatively age-old debate regarding the supremacy of Mega Man 2 or 3. Now that both are available on the eShop, a discussion regarding the various reasons why some might choose one over the other seems timely. What say you, RFN crew?
Well, I'll get this out of the way right now. Mega Man 3 on the Game Boy, way better than Mega Man 2 on the Game Boy. I know, that's a burning question.
Yeah, oh, that's good to know.
Yeah.
Oh my god, the Mega Man Land games, as I refer to them. Oh my god.
Mega Man Land.
I don't want to talk about those games. I don't...
Well,
I've right, them,
so
I've played
those,
them.
Those are the versions that I grew up with, that I know, so I'm
yeah,
sorry, I don't
yeah,
have a good
for
answer
sure.
for the NES ones. I played the NES ones on the collection.
Oh god,
with controls
really?
Reversed. So they were all brutal. Kind of... bad.
Did you play the GameCube or the PS2 version?
I now own, thank God, a copy of the PS2 version, but
oh,
I haven't gone through all the games on that version yet.
The Capcom, the GameCube version is, so for those of you who don't know, Capcom completely effed up the controls on the GameCube version.
Yeah.
It is unfathomable. It just doesn't make any sense. They got it right.
That's the Mega Man collection, just to be clear.
Right, they got it right on X collection, but the first...
Yep.
I mean, it almost renders some of the games unplayable because your muscle memory is just keeps screwing you up.
It's also totally unnecessary and stupid.
I guess it's something I can brag about that I finished the first Mega Man game with reverse controls.
Yes, you should brag about that.
Oh, it's
that
so
game's
impossible.
Hard to finish on with any controls.
Yeah, it's ugh. Anyway, I mean, earlier in the episode, I bragged as the Mega Man expert here, but what's gonna be kind of weird is that there's a very loud and vocal, I would say, majority of people who think Mega Man 2 is the better game.
Hmm.
And then there's this small group that absolutely adores 3. And to me, they're different games. I don't particularly have preference on them. To me, where preference starts to kick in is when you get towards the later Mega Man games, like 7 and 8. Or when you're dealing with... It just doesn't feel like they stepped enough in those early ones for me to go like, clearly this is the best game. I think
5 is the worst, just because it's very forgettable. The characters and the
yeah,
stages
I mean,
in 5 are not very distinct. I think with 6, few people have played it because it was a really late NES game. It came out in like 1994,
yeah.
Something like that. But I think Mega Man 6 is actually kind of a return to form and has a lot of cool new ideas, and it really stands out and is very good.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I'm not really bothered by either of those games. I mean, I like 2 and 3 a lot. I mean, 5, yeah, 5's kind of whatever. 8, we don't talk about 8. 8 is a thing that exists, but is mostly ignored, you know.
I like 8. I mean, 8, the thing about 8 is the graphics are awesome because it's 32-bit.
Right. I just don't like how it plays.
So it just looks fantastic. 7 looks really good too, but 7 is really rare.
Yeah.
It's a Super Nintendo game, and it's one of the least played Mega Man games, probably.
Why would they make Mega Man 7 after making Mega Man 10? You guys have never gotten to that conversation as kids? That's okay. Forget
it. No one's ever asked me that, but that's funny.
As long as you're not dealing with, like, I don't know, Mega Man and Bass or whatever. I mean, play 2, play 3, enjoy them both because they're both really awesome games. That's really what I have to say about it.
While I don't have an opinion, I can tell you what other people's opinions is.
Opinions?
Well, like, the proponents of Mega Man 3 seem to say that the game is better designed because, what's it called, the metal blade. The metal blade in Mega Man 2 is overpowered and kind of breaks the game.
It's a little bit OP.
While 3 has no such imbalance. Plus, you get all the robot masters from the second game anyway. So, you know, it's got everything and it's better designed.
That in that game, that feels like a gift. At some point in the X series, you're like, come on, Capcom, I don't fucking care anymore. Stop it.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that was the first time they had really done that.
They go down that bridge a few too many times.
Yeah. It was innovative at the time. That's kind of the direction I was heading with my logic, is that I feel like 2 is definitely the more nostalgic choice.
Yep.
It was definitely where the series came into its own. It is dramatically better than the first Mega Man.
Yeah, the first game is very... If you've not played Mega Man game before 4, I think if you played 1, you'd be like, what the fuck is this?
Yeah, the first one's a little rough. Mega Man 2 is brilliant, and also because it is broken in multiple ways, especially the Metal Blade.
The Metal Blade especially, yes.
It's probably one of the more accessible Mega Man games, because if you know how to break it, and it's actually not even that hard to figure it out on your own, you can play through the game. And even it is a difficult game. They're all difficult. But Mega Man 2, because it has exploits in it, I think there are things you can do to, to kind of force your way through it. And I think if you look at the design of Mega Man 9 and 10, I think Capcom definitely thinks that 2 is the best, or is the most iconic.
I think they think it's the most nostalgic, so that's the one they're going to play.
Yeah, the most popular.
On.
And I'm sure Mega Man 2 is more popular.
Oh, it is.
No doubt about that.
It definitively is, yeah.
Yeah. But I had both, and I played both a lot, and, I have to say, Mega Man 2, for everything I love about it, I do think the soundtrack is probably better in 2.
Yeah, it is.
And that
counts
for a lot in Mega Man, really. That's important.
Yeah.
But there are some stages in that game that are so bullshit. I'm thinking of you, Quick Man. and there are levels I love. I actually really love Flash Man's stage. I love the kind of the slippery nature of it and the kind of maze-like, vertical maze-like where you're falling through and you're trying to catch yourself on ledges. I think there's some really brilliant stuff in there. But then I look at stuff like Snake Man's level in Mega Man 3, and that level is absolutely nuts. It is so brilliant.
Oh, yeah.
And it just does things with kind of... I hate to use the word physics for an NES game, but it does kind of mess with your knowledge of how the character moves and how he jumps and how to kind of access enemies and the timing of your jumps to hit an enemy. It plays with all those things so well, and then the boss ends up being weirdly challenging considering his attacks all run on the ground, just because he jumps around like a maniac. And I feel like in the end, I think Mega Man 3 plays better. I may not have quite the emotional attachment to it that I do with 2, but I think Mega Man 3, they added the slide, which makes it gives you more tactical options in combat, especially with bosses. Huge on bosses to be able to slide.
Yeah.
It adds the Proto Man character, who's a mini boss in that game, and is a pretty challenging mini boss for the most part. And he's a very mysterious character. He has that cool whistly music tone that pops in when he comes down.
He has a cape because he's a badass.
I think Mega Man 3, the fact that not only do you get to replay all the bosses from 2, but you also, it takes you back through the levels, through the Mega Man 3 levels a second time, but now they're all ruined and changed, and the level layouts have been modified and the graphics have been modified. That is really cool. And I love the idea that, you play through this level and you beat the robot master, and you're actually kind of leaving this wake of destruction behind you.
Right.
And then they actually kind of force you to go back through and look at what you have wrought upon these places and meet the vengeance of of those masters, you know, when you get to the end of it. I mean, it's I probably have to come down on Mega Man 3 being the better game. It is better balanced for sure. It's more, you know, it has more features, but the features it adds are very intelligent, I feel like. And overall, I think it's probably just a little more well-rounded. There's definitely more to it. There's more value to it. But Mega Man 2 is just this kind of quintessential NES game, because it's like, this is when the masters of the NES, like Capcom, finally got it. They finally figured out the hardware. If you look at the story of how that game was made, it was almost like a fan tribute game made by the people who made the first Mega Man. Right. Like, they made it all in their spare time because the first game didn't do that well and Capcom wouldn't greenlight the sequel. So they built the demo in their free time, like working late at night and on weekends, because they really believed in it and they wanted to show Capcom that they could make a sequel that would be much better and would appeal to people. And it totally worked. And the second game was a massive success. So, I mean, you have to love it for all of those things.
It's like the Mega Capcom.
Sorry, do we even know what game they were working on during the daytime? Has that endured at all?
No, I mean... I'm sure someone, it could have easily been DuckTales or something like that. I don't know for sure.
It's probably the console port of 1942.
Wow.
Who knows?
I mean, for me, all of those Mega Man games from that era sort of kind of form together. I mean, I know the differences because I've played them all a bunch of times, but to me, that series really pivots once the first X game comes out.
Mm-hmm.
So, to me, if you're going to ask me what's my favorite Mega Man game, it's probably going to have X somewhere in the title. 3, 4, somewhere in that neighborhood. Because those games are so fast. Yeah. So you know, I go back and I look at where I was when I played 2 and 3 and go, man, I sucked at games. What the hell? X X would kick my butt, man. This is ridiculous. But, you know, that's kind of... I bet if X had never come out, I'd probably be super militant about 2 or 3, and I can't tell you which one.
3 is faster because of the slide.
It is. It is a lot. It is not a lot faster. It is noticeably faster.
Yeah.
So maybe I'd come down there, but I think it, for me, that whole argument died when the Superior X series came into being. Because at that, well, to a point, because the X series goes off into the fucking toilet at around 5, so don't write me hate mail.
3 also was the debut of Rush, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, because in 2 you have the devices. You know, you have like device number 1, device number 2. It's very similar to what Rush does in 3, but in 3 they actually made it into a character, and now he is your robotic dog, which is way cooler.
Yeah, Rush is definitely in 3, so...
Yeah.
I don't believe him to be in 2. So
there's another kind of plus in the column for Mega Man 3. So yeah, I think Mega Man 3 probably is the better game. It would be hard for me to say which one I like more because it's such an emotional issue, you know. And 2 is a very emotional game for a lot of people our age who discovered it back at that time.
Did you guys back in the day play through 2 on normal or hard? Because
normal. Okay. Normal is already pretty hard.
I don't find much enjoyment out of 2 on the collection, but that's because it's a different game. Like, it's the Japanese version. Basically, it's the difficult version.
Right. I probably played it on hard because I was an idiot.
Right.
I could do this.
I don't know. It's a little bit hardcore.
I was also like 4, so come on. Just deal with the fact I was a little kid.
All right, so let's move on to the next email, and Guillaume is going to read this one.
Key Billy writes, I think it is fair to say that the tablet concept for the Wii U has proven to be useful, but has failed to create enough excitement to drive sales. The biggest innovation in control recently has been the Kinect, and despite the cold reception by the hardcore, quote-unquote, it has made many families happy. As I was considering what Nintendo's response might be, I realized that they may have built the Wii U around it. Streaming low-latency video is the main hurdle to overcome for a wireless VR system. Think Oculus Rift.
Oh, God.
The Wii U is set up out of the box to support a relatively inexpensive peripheral that could make gaming much more immersive and also drive major buzz. What do you guys think? Is this a totally ridiculous idea?
If we start talking about the Oculus Rift, does this turn into Giant Bomb?
Well, no. the thing about Oculus Rift, I can see why people like John Carmack and whoever at Valve and everyone is so into it. Like, they're big tech guys.
Right.
And I can see why it draws big tech guys. But if you're trying to draw families...
Put this dumb thing on your head that no one else can see what's going on.
I've got news for you. I don't think that's what they want. I don't think they're that interested. And I think asking people to plunk down a couple $100s per headset to play together games and not really see each other... You know, can you imagine four people with four Oculus Rifts in the living room?
Yes, yes, I can.
That is the weirdest thing. Like, that's out
sounds
of
it. Sounds like a disaster.
Sounds awesome.
It sounds like a movie from the 90s.
It does. The 80s, really.
You're also not really playing locally. You're not really, right. you're not really doing couch gaming anymore at that point because
no.
You also probably can't hear each other very well.
No.
Because the whole point of the immersion is that it's probably going to have headphones built into it like the Oculus does.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're spinning around or moving your head all over the place, you don't want to be dependent on your shitty TV speakers to be sending the sound to you. So, no, you're exactly right, Guillaume. I mean, it's the total opposite of what Nintendo wants to do, which is to get people playing together.
And if you only can use one at a time, mostly it's people watching the head of somebody else. I mean, I've used one of these really, really high-end virtual reality immersion headsets where you put what is essentially the helmet / mask on, like you're Darth Vader, and there's just screen all the way around you, and mm-hmm. your ears are completely covered in noise-canceling headsets that are really goddamn loud.
Yeah.
So you can't hear anything else, and you just sit there and... The controls are there at your hands. You just kind of have to know where they are. I was actually playing it in the context of an actual, like, real jet fighter simulator that they had built, like, a portable version of. So instead of having a bunch of screens, you put the headset on.
Oh, cool.
Hmm. And I crashed. But, yeah, it was...
Did it come with a server stack to run the sim?
Pretty much. It had a bunch of... It had, like, three PCs stuck behind the damn thing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's one they actually train real pilots on. And it was really nice. Cool, but I wouldn't want to play games on it. I mean, it was a very stressful experience to play. I mean, because your brain is just taking in so much sensory information at one time that you're just sort of going like, oh my god, oh my god, oh my god, oh my god. I mean, it really wasn't that hard to do what I was trying to do. I was already in the air. I was just trying to maneuver, and my brain was just gone. I mean, it was just trying to... Bam.
Well, but I mean, your first time is probably not representative. I mean,
no,
just like the 3DS, you know, how you adapt to it over time, you get used to how it looks and you learn to process it a little better or using an analog joystick for the first time. It seems impossible at first.
But how would you sell it is the point.
At PAX East, we played one round of Steel Battalion. I still wouldn't say that I've played Steel Battalion.
You know? You've been barked at about Steel Battalion.
Yeah, plenty. Basically.
I think the whole virtual reality thing is really cool, and it does seem like we're getting a lot closer to this becoming consumer grade technology.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly the thing that was promised to us 20 years ago was way
right.
overly ambitious and didn't actually work the way that you would imagine that it would. I think we are getting a lot closer to that now. Is that something that Nintendo would get behind? You know, they tried it with Virtual Boy, and I don't know that they were going for the whole sensory deprivation chamber.
But they did it.
I don't think that's why they went with Virtual Boy. I think they did that stuff because it was the only way to make that technology work.
Right.
And I think they learned a pretty tough lesson from it, which is that the people didn't really like it very much. And
no.
Even with the technology being a lot better nowadays, you have to imagine that anything that even looks like Virtual Boy has to scare the shit out of Nintendo.
I think that Keybilly is really coming from the looking at the tech of the Wii U tablet and saying, like, basically Nintendo has the technology right now to do this. So should they do it? So I'm kind of picturing kind of a, you know, like those crummy plastic accessories that the Wii had. Like, what if Nintendo came up with like a plastic helmet that you just slide the gamepad into And so, and then you just fire up Google Maps and whoa, it's like I'm actually in my street outside of my house, but I'm in my house.
I was hoping you go like, it's like I'm actually in Tibet, and then I was going to drop it. It's like I'm actually stalking John Lindemann.
I would love to see that helmet that holds the gamepad, you know, 2 inches in front of your face.
Don't worry, Nyko's on it.
That's actually kind of hilarious.
But it's true that the tablet has like a magnetometer, you know, it's got the gyros, it's got the screen. So basically, yeah, like the Nintendo has the tech. It could do it, but will it? It's probably not a good idea.
No, you're right, and it's a good point. And the low latency wireless is a huge part of this, and I fully appreciate that comparison. But just it's one thing to say Nintendo has the tech; it's another to say is the tech that they have good enough to actually pull this off? And the answer is no. The screen on that gamepad, even if you don't plug the gamepad into anything and you just use the wireless stuff that's in the gamepad and build that into a new peripheral that is just kind of some kind of headset, even then it would be so expensive to put the screens into it that actually do this. I mean, Oculus Rift is, I don't think we know what the actual price is, but it's going to be hundreds of dollars.
I don't think they know yet either. I think they're still
That thing's not been released yet. But it's going to be expensive. And, you know, even then we've heard that they may be struggling with some issues of, you know, the head tracking, the motion control parts of it not being fast enough to fully keep up with what they're showing on the screens. This is not easy to do.
Yeah, and if you get that wrong, especially the head tracking stuff, you can cause people to throw up.
Yeah, oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, look at the physical, you know, feedback they got from Virtual Boy was very so negative. You know, people said it, and it did it. It gives you a headache. It makes your eyes burn after a while.
That's what people said of the 3DS, even.
Yeah, some people. So you know, they're very sensitive to these things, and I just don't see this as being a priority for them right now. But I also think we shouldn't. I mean, this is just a thought experiment. We shouldn't take it that seriously, but I think the idea that Nintendo would sort of abandon their commitment to the gamepad itself and to the whole tablet gaming thing in favor of, you know, putting a lot of energy and attention into some other weird peripheral like this that's expensive and high risk, you know, I don't think they've given up on the tablet yet.
Abandon all hope, ye who stick a tablet in front of your face.
You know, you can argue that they, over time with Wii, kind of gave up on motion control. But then they did Skyward Sword right at the very end. And that game is hella motion control. So I think they're, you know, the Wii U does a lot of different things, as we've discussed, maybe too many different things. And you know, it's going to take them time to develop all the ideas to use different parts of it. And every game will use the system in a different way. Not every game is going to use every feature that it has. But I certainly would not assume that they've given up on the whole gamepad control mechanism and given up on looking for ideas on what they can do with it. I think we'll see at E3 how committed they really are to it. If they start talking, they're going to have the Wii Fit balance board for sure.
Right.
Kind of a known quantity. But if they go back and start talking about the whole vitality sensor and a whole bunch of other weird input shit, then I am going to be concerned about their commitment to the gamepad, because they spent a lot of money developing that thing. And, you know, it's, again, we've said it before, but it's easy to look at it and say it really doesn't do anything differently than an iPad. That's false. That thing is unique technology. It is proprietary to what they're doing. And I don't even think Sony is going to be able to replicate the functionality and the smoothness of the Wii U gamepad with their whole Vita PS4 thing. So I think what Nintendo has done is not easy. I'm not sure they've proved that it was worthwhile at this point, but there's still a lot of time for them to make that case. And that's what they better be working on now. I'd rather them be working on the games that prove the gamepad was worth all that time and money and effort put into it, rather than them trying to come up with alternatives to it this early.
Although I do like Oculus Rift U.
And, you know, like, one very important point I think that we haven't really discussed And that perhaps it makes too much sense, but Nintendo doesn't make first-person games very much.
Oh, yeah. That's true. That's a good point.
That's a Japanese thing, really. I mean,
yeah. But I mean, like, you're not going to play Mario with an Oculus Rift. You're just not. You're going to throw up. You're not going to play Zelda. It's just...
Oh, God.
And Japanese people have a genetic predisposition to motion sickness. So the idea that this would come out of a Japanese company is rather unlikely.
Yeah, and the people behind the Oculus Rift right now, the biggest names, the loudest people who are, you know, the biggest proponents, make first-person shooters. This is because this is a device for first-person shooters.
Right.
Or, you know, dogfighting simulations or racing games.
It could be, I mean, you could extend it to things like first-person RPGs like Skyrim.
Yeah, yeah, but you're not going to be playing Braid on this thing.
No, that's a great point. Good, very good point. Yeah, this wouldn't even make sense for a Mario. They would have to come up with entirely new games to support it. And
first-person Pikmin, do it.
All right. So the final email this week comes from Nate in North Carolina. Nate writes, "As I played through Mighty Switch Force, I saw a lot of the same enemy and puzzle types that were in A Boy and His Blob. So instead of turning a blob into a hole and letting an enemy fall through, you flip a switch to do it. You also have the same charging enemies and flying enemies. For some reason, this bothers me. Although I see game mechanics and enemy types and other NPCs make the jump, that's non-player characters, make the jump from one unrelated game to another, I felt in this case it comes across as lazy. Other examples of devs reusing their own ideas could include Ubisoft, like Prince of Persia and Assassin's Creed, Blizzard, WoW and Diablo, all of Gearbox's games, just kidding, and maybe Bungie's upcoming Destiny game, although that remains to be seen. So, when does it go from acceptable to inexcusable for a developer to reuse their own ideas for games that are not related to each other? And what other examples can you think of?"
I don't know that... So, first off, I think the most unacceptable thing about Mighty Switch Force is that it's boring as hell. But it is a tremendously boring game. But the Ubisoft example of Prince of Persia versus Assassin's Creed. Now, keep in mind, I'm talking from the context of someone who played Assassin's Creed 1 and has not come back to the franchise since then.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was a nice progression from Prince of Persia, this very closed world platforming mechanic, to sort of taking those same mechanics and spreading them out over a city.
In a totally different setting, yeah.
Right. Which is why I always get pissy whenever we talk about that series and say, why does it keep taking me back to this stupid fucking lab? I don't care. I just want to stay in that time period because that time period is cool. Your sci-fi bullshit is bullshit. I want to be here. And I like just going through a city and running over the rooftops and jumping from building to building and like grabbing curtains as I'm flying through the air to go up. The problem with that in those games, and they both have it, is that it's way too easy to recognize from the environmental cues, oh, I can climb up that, oh, I can swing on that. And I think what I'm okay
with... That's something
with,
they tried to fix in 3, especially with the tree running. They wanted to make it more organic and for you to kind of push on the environment and see where you can go, because visually it's not necessarily obvious.
So
they wanted to make the environments look more natural, and your character therefore feels maybe even a little bit more superhuman for having the ability to kind of navigate these very intricate structures.
To me, where it's okay to take these sort of steps, as long as they remain evolutionary, that it's okay to continue to take this thing from one game that's not really connected to this other game and move them across. So for me, going from Prince of Persia to Assassin's Creed was fine because it opened the world up. I would have liked to have seen what Johnny's talking about is apparently in 3, which is... Mm-hmm. It makes it less of like a, this is a wall you can climb. Because in Prince of Persia, where it was very closed corridors, that made sense because they were highlighting the route you should take.
Yeah.
And in fact, there was a power to show you the route to take. Whereas in Assassin's Creed, you really should be going anywhere you want, so it didn't make sense in that context.
Mm-hmm.
But where I run into problems with this is when the game either takes the same stuff and does it incorrectly, or just doesn't enhance it in the slightest.
Yeah, I think you never want to feel that the content has been recycled. And, you know, it could be in the case of, I mean, look, Mighty Switch Force and Buena's Blob are very different games. They are both sort of 2D platformers, but they have a different pace to them. They have very different gameplay. But, you know, there are certain tropes, and I think it's maybe just, I don't know if Nate played these games back-to-back. You know, being from the same developer, probably a lot of the same people worked on both of the games. There are going to be similarities, and if you play them in really close succession, some of those things might be more obvious to you than you would like. The idea that flying enemies are you know, appearing in both games as lazy is really weird to me. It depends on what is the context of those flying enemies and how do they behave and how do you deal with them? Because it could be exactly literally the same artwork and the same AI pattern and everything, but because in a Buena's Blob you don't have an attack, you have to deal with it in a totally different way. Maybe that's okay.
You can't really jump.
Yeah.
Well, Capcom does that though. Capcom had some old 8-bit and 16-bit games that recycled the same enemy but forced you to confront them in totally different mechanisms. Mm-hmm. I think in the...
Oh, I got the good example of this.
Okay.
The Sigma fight in Mega Man X. You know, the whole standing on Sigma's hands to reach the head and hit it.
Yep.
That was recycled in one of the Zelda Oracle of Something games.
One of the flagship games, yeah.
Yeah, like you just, it's the exact same boss.
Well, it makes you funny about it. That gets recycled in like 3 other Mega Man X games as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Mega Man X3 and X4, you ride Sigma's hands up to shoot him in the face. Which yeah. really made me think he'd stop lifting his hands to his face. But
those are sequels, and that's not the subject of this question. It's more about going from series to series. But
right, but that was like flagrant to me, like it, playing Zelda, just like, whoa. This became Mega Man. I did not expect that.
It's probably meant more as a tribute because in those cases, I mean, Mega Man plays so differently than Zelda that I would say it's okay.
right. Yeah, the context is different. As you said, that it's an example of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, these are sequels, but one place, one game or series that I played relatively recently, back-to-back, where... essentially, everything you can do in one game, you can do in the other, but it feels so very different, is the difference between the first Zone of the Enders game and the second, where it's the same game, but it just feels different because of how they tweaked pace. I really think it comes down to just, does the developer do a good job with taking an idea and representing that idea sort of distinctly from itself?
It's all about execution, and you know, I can understand when it's not done properly, this could be something that would annoy you. When it's done extremely well, this is something that people love. You know, when you bring these elements across genres and across franchises, you bring back certain kinds of encounters or certain art assets or something like that. If you do it in a clever way that doesn't feel like you're just rehashing content, a lot of times fans love this kind of thing.
Especially in 2D games, like at some point you're limited in what you can do. And so it's kind of unavoidable to repeat ideas. And there are certain things in platformers, for instance, that just became kind of part of the language of the genre. Like, for instance, like since the very first Mario, you can jump on an enemy. And if you hold down the jump button, you're going to jump higher. You're using it as a trampoline, basically.
Yeah.
And then that's in every Mario game since. That's in Sonic. That's a huge part of Braid.
I was going to say Braid even.
Yeah. Like it's what you expect, you know, and it's hard to be bothered by that. It's just, yeah, it's become very familiar at this point, but it feels right.
To not do that would be seen as either incompetence or it could be seen as you intentionally subverting players' expectations, which again could be fantastic. But even if you intentionally subvert it and you do something that's the total opposite of what people expect, you're still incorporating those expectations. In other words, that it wouldn't work if the player didn't already think one thing was going to happen. You couldn't surprise them by making a different thing happen. And so even in those cases, this is still going on. You're still making references to the things that have come before. I don't think it's intrinsically a problem. I think it can be a problem if you do it poorly.
Yeah, I think ultimately it just comes down to how do you execute. And I think to an extent people can see, I don't want to say see your motivation, but can understand if you're doing it because it's easy or doing it because you're making a good homage to what you're trying to mm-hmm. illustrate. And I think the other extent is you can do it so well that people don't even notice you did it.
Yeah.
And that's always the weirdest feeling, is if you get this thing in the back of your head, like, this feels really familiar, what am I doing? And you just never can put it together.
What if you made a Castlevania game that referenced Smash Brothers Brawl so subtly that only one person in the world noticed it?
Greg Leahy writes a blog post about it.
All right, so that's a good place to end this discussion. Thanks, everyone, for writing in. And like I said, we actually have a lot more emails in the pile that are really good. So we're going to try to get through more of those soon. Thanks again, everybody who wrote in. And we will be getting to more of your emails in a couple of weeks after we finish up Retroactive. That's coming up on the next episode. We are going to talk about Ease Book 2. So if you are playing along and you haven't yet dropped your comments into the forum thread, I hope you will go do that. You can find a link in the show notes for this episode at NWR. And if you have an email, if anything we said today, anything going on in the world of video games piqued your interest and you would like to write in about it, you can do that at rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And there is also a link to that in the show notes for this episode. Wanted to mention that you can hear more talk about PAX, about stuff that we did, some of it Nintendo related, some of it not, some of it just kind of crazy stuff. We get way deep into Johann Sebastian Joust, which I am always advocating. Anyway, all of that is in
and I'm a champion.
Is in a segment that we recorded in the hotel for Connectivity. And I believe on the current episode that came out probably the day before this show, you can hear all three of us, plus a lot of other NWR staffers, talk about all the stuff that they did at PAX East, and I highly recommend that you go check that out. It's also at the website, or you can search for Connectivity on iTunes. And again, their panel audio might be part of that same episode. They might release it separately. I'm not sure what their plans are right now, but I would definitely recommend also that you check out the Who Wants to Be a Nintendo Air panel, because that was a lot of fun. That's going to do it for this week. Thanks everyone for listening. We'll be back next time with John and Ease and
Johnny's.
Lots more.
Whoa.
and Johnny's.
Put that in your head.
Yeah. That's head gold, man. All right. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.
I think I'm going to do an errata right now. Perhaps the whole holding down the jump button to use enemies as a trampoline thing was not in the very first Mario game. I am starting to doubt myself now.
I think it was.
Do you jump higher? Hmm. Or do you just bounce on them, whatever you do?
You definitely do in the third one.
Yes. So let's go with that.
Okay. Maybe it comes from Mario 3. Okay.
Yes.
All right. Fair enough.